The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we ask a few of our writers to read their piece from the magazine aloud. On this episode, Fraser Nelson starts by reading our leading article. The Prime Minister promised data not dates, but with deaths from coronavirus down 99%, 85% of over 60s now having antibodies, and new variants showing little sign of changing things, should we reopen before June 21st? Fiona Mountford is on next, arguing that corporate friendliness is cheap and meaningless. Where are the good old days of dispassionate professionalism? Then, Laurie Graham reads her piece. She wonders what her church group should put in their COVID time capsule to be opened in 2071. And finally, Isabel Hardman reads her notes on dandelions, the cheeriest of wildflowers, she says. First up, Fraser Nelson, reading our leading article.
A slogan can come back to haunt you. For Boris Johnson, the words data not dates sounded pretty powerful at the time when COVID cases were high and hospitals were full. His idea was that the government would be guided by scientific reason. It would respond to the figures. It would not let rigid targets dictate policy. But since he announced his roadmap at the end of February, dates do seem to have become a lot more important than data. How, after all, can he claim to be following the data when he will not budge from a timeline which now looks like it was designed for a very different phase of the pandemic? Why were people braving the cold and the rain outside restaurants on a bank holiday Monday when there's every chance that it was safe to go inside? There's nothing in the data, we're told, to suggest that we should further delay the dates laid out in the roadmap. But here's the question, is there anything in the data that makes it inappropriate to bring reopening forwards, given the economic and the societal harm that the restrictions still inflict? Professor Neil Ferguson, whose controversial COVID modelling informed of a lockdown policy, now admits that there is very little justification in making the hospitality industry wait until the 17th of May to allow customers to eat and drink indoors and to stay in hotels. Nor is there any reason why we should have to wait until the 21st of June for theatres and sports venues to fully reopen. The risk of a serious third wave over the summer and autumn, Ferguson says, has all but disappeared, thanks to the success of the vaccine programme. At a time where we should be working to restore freedoms, the government is, if anything, pushing in a different direction. When the Prime Minister announced that roadmap in February, there was no mention of vaccine passports. Indeed, the Vaccines Minister ruled them out. But an official review into whether to bring them in is still ongoing, and a massive head of steam is now building behind the system. Nor did the roadmap have any mention of continuing requirements for masks and social distancing and obsessive weekly testing after the 21st of June. That was the date we were led to believe when life would go back to normal. What we have seen is deaths and infections fall by 99%. Yet week by week, new ways of keeping society in the emergency ward are being dreamed up. Even right now, pupils in secondary schools are still being forced to wear masks. Yet with twice weekly testing, less than 0.4% of these pupils are testing positive. So at what point are ministers going to accept that the lateral flow testing on this scale is now pretty pointless and, furthermore, represents a pretty big waste of public money? Tests show that 85% of the over 60s now have COVID antibodies. So it's hard, perhaps impossible, to see how any third wave could threaten to overwhelm the health services. And so far, there is no evidence that the new variants have changed this equation. If vaccine passports are brought in, and if they are used to exclude people from mass events, that would be a pretty big change in a democracy that has never accepted identity cards for people going about for lawful business. Number 10 has already admitted that vaccine passports would be discriminatory. Also, we've put together an analysis of the vaccine figures at The Spectator, and they show that amongst whites, vaccine take-up is certainly high. Barely 10% of whites over the age of 50 are unvaccinated, but that figure is 28% among South Asians and 35% in the black community. Now, just think about what that would mean if vaccine passports were to be introduced. Think of the sort of people who would end up being excluded. Can ministers really turn a blind eye to the sort of discrimination, ethnic discrimination, that vaccine passports would inadvertently threaten? That's why the idea should be dropped without delay. Boris Johnson was right when, as editor of The Spectator, he denounced identity cards as an affront to British liberty and a capitulation to the security state. The fact that an official COVID certification system could be implemented long after almost everybody has received their first jab raises even more suspicions about its actual purpose. Israel is finding out that its green card is unnecessary in a population that now has pretty high levels of immunity. That's why it's crucial that MPs simply do not approve COVID certification for domestic use or whatever new name is given to the vaccine passports. They're unnecessary, they're unwelcome, and they're un-British. Now, we're never going to be free of the risk of a new pandemic. Only now we see that the Indian variant has been upgraded to a variant of concern. COVID has got a habit of surprising us, and it could still do so again. We could be struck at any time by a completely different virus, perhaps even a new influenza virus, but we simply cannot keep ordinary life on hold forever. Only this week, some care home residents have been allowed out of their accommodation for the first time in a year. They've been subject to degrading regulations that have been justified in the name of their safety. Now, one of the things that we've learned from the crisis is just how hard it is for those in power to relax liberal measures when they've been imposed under emergency conditions, even once the situation improves. Boris Johnson himself has remarked in private that he's been struck how easy it has been to take away people's liberties and how hard it is to give them back. That's why, when politicians adopt the habit of government by command, they tend to cease to trust people to make decisions about their own lives. But at some point, however, this government has simply got to acknowledge that the pandemic in Britain is over and that normal life is now safe to resume. And the figures and the data suggest that date should come sooner rather than later.
That was the leading article in this week's magazine. Now, Fiona Mountford.
Customer disservice. Have you noticed it? The slide towards faux friendliness and fake sincerity from the companies with whom we used to have an impersonal and transactional relationship. The deal used to be simple. We paid them, they did things or provided stuff, thank you and goodbye. If something went awry, we told them and, with luck, they fixed it. Feelings, other than occasional frustration, did not come into it. But in recent years, presumably inspired by American corporate culture, companies are no longer content with worming their way into our wallets. Now they want to commandeer the emotional part of our brains as well. They've done their research into behavioural science and the psychology of retail. They have started to emote, to empathise, to understand, and to chat. I'm still reeling from the recent chat I had with my bank, HSBC. I logged on to my online banking with the simple goal of ordering a new chequebook. After a few minutes of futile clicking, a cheery chatbot popped up, inquiring whether I needed any assistance. I typed my one-line request. The chatbot apologised airily but said it didn't know what I was talking about. I tried again. Nope. The bank's chatting machine had never heard of checkbooks or the ordering thereof, but was absolutely there to help me. This exchange carried on, until finally it gave in and suggested I call the helpline or pop into my local branch, which is shortly to be closed, as all our banking needs can be carried out online. Having assisted with nothing, this electronic gremlin rounded off our conversation by asking if there was anything else I can help you with, and wishing me a nice day. What on earth would our grandparents' pragmatic generation have made of this sort of institutional nonsense? I blame the London Olympics. Until early 2012, the deal was clear and the lines were drawn. We were the customers and they, the blissfully vague they that control so much of life, were the providers, and there was much clear water between us. yet gradually the effects of some sort of mass rebranding campaign to make the capital, and by transference the whole country, more user-friendly began to be felt. No longer were tubes not running due to a signal failure, but while we fix a signal failure. Language became more personal, and there was much apologising for the inconvenience thrown in for good measure. The world was coming to us, and we needed to be on our best behaviour. Here's the crucial test. Since this infestation of the language of feelings, has customer service got any better? I would say no, certainly not. If anything, it has taken a turn for the worse. We apologise for the inconvenience has become the catchphrase of the terminally mediocre. Far too many organisations have taken to the belief that saying sorry for some shabbiness is an acceptable substitute for actually fixing the problem. Take a look at the Twitter replies of any supermarket for a glimpse of how prevalent corporate mea culpas are. In their book, The Apology Impulse, How the Business World Ruins Sorry and Why We Can't Stop Saying It, Sean O'Meara and Carey Cooper helpfully crunch the numbers. On one day in 2018, Sainsbury's, Tesco, Asda and Morrisons made a total of 151 customer service apologies between them on Twitter. Sainsbury's apologised 31 times, Tesco 29 times, Morrisons 41 times, and Asda found sorry to be the least hard word by apologising 50 times. It is all too easy to be liberal with this cheap and meaningless language. A nasty strain of passive aggressiveness has crept in too. I'm sorry you feel that way is a popular one. I tried in vain to explain to the gas distribution company Cadent that its tarmacking over of part of my front garden was not a subjective sensation, but an empirical fact. I did not, I struggled to assure them, want to be their friend or to be concerned about hurt feelings. I would just like my roses to be left in peace and my gas meter to work, and, if necessary, to pay them by cheque. Nonetheless, their needlessly emotional emails carried on, as did the apologies for the inconvenience, an inconvenience that grew rather than lessened as the weeks rolled onwards. That's by the by in this brave new world of corporations as frenemies. It is not doing the right thing, but saying the right thing that counts. As for those who long for the olden days of dispassionate interactions in professional contexts, well, I'm sorry you feel that way.
That was Fiona Mountford. Next, Laurie Graham.
The ladies of my church knitting circle. Please note we are open to those who identify otherly and to practitioners of diverse crafts. The ladies are an enterprising bunch and no techno slouches either. Unbowed by COVID, we have continued to meet via Zoom, bringing along our own tea, cake and creative endeavours. We love a project, and we now have one, a time capsule of the plague year. This idea is so far proving to be more a feasibility study than a done deal. There are so many decisions to make. What size should the capsule be? Where will it be stored? When will it be reopened? And by whom? And what will they find when they do? A ruling on the size of the container is still at committee stage, though I believe it's unlikely to be large enough to accommodate that icon of first lockdown madness, a toilet roll. The decision not to bury our capsule was reached unanimously. In a parish built on granite, why make life any harder? Our sealed box will be stashed in the vestry, to be opened 50 years from now. 50 years is a modest lifespan for a time capsule. We chose it on the basis that there may then be people, now children, still around to witness the opening and remember this strange year. Those of us who wonder whether the church will even be functioning by 2071 keep our doomy thoughts to ourselves. So, assuming our capsule hasn't been binned during the conversion of the church into a vegan restaurant, who is going to remember to open it and with due ceremony? How can we, who will long be in our graves, remind such a person that the time has come? One of our members, Crochet and Tech Support, has been tasked with finding out if any event reminder apps have calendars as far ahead as 2071. You can't bottle fear or loss or hope. Our ideas for the contents of the capsule are modest and perhaps predictable. A hand-sewn mask, a recipe for banana bread, photographs, musings, pressed flowers from a sanity-saving garden, an ancient mobile phone, small brown coins rendered useless by shops that will only accept tap and go. But with each idea comes an attendant problem. No sense, for instance, in burning a CD of the blessed return of audible birdsong, because who, in 2071, will have the means of playing a CD? Remember floppy disks? And you can't just seal things in a box willy-nilly and hope for the best. Mice, moths, silverfish, spores, they'll all be in there having a party. And even without their assistance, stuff degrades. It's called entropy, and we are getting a crash course in it. Take paper. Those poems, recipes, and grandchildren's drawings we've collected, are they on buffered paper or unbuffered? Buffered if I know. But it matters. The consensus among conservators seems to be that buffered is generally best, because over time even supposedly acid-free paper can become slightly acidic. However, for items of animal origin, unbuffered paper is to be preferred, an important consideration when it comes to wrapping, say, any knitted masterpieces. Wool, which is literally a staple of our crafting materials, exudes sulphurous fumes over time. Who knew? Newsprint, on the other hand, exudes something else. Methane, methinks. Black and white photographs apparently survive in better shape than coloured ones, and things written in soft pencil or old-fashioned ink do better than, say, felt-tip pens. No staples, paper clips, or rubber bands, and every item needs to be bagged in polyethylene and separated by leaves of lignin-free, archival quality tissue paper. Otherwise, the imaginatively curated contents of your time capsule will turn to smelly, unidentifiable mush. Our project has taught me a wonderful collectible expression, which alone has made the journey worthwhile. Inherent vice. It means that as soon as one item starts to decay, anything touching it is liable to go the same way. One damned thing leads to another. I've always suspected as much. We are now edging slowly towards our final edit. As off-piste crafters, we don't usually work in teams or follow rules, but this capsule will be an exception. I'm quite prepared to see my yet another lockdown Easter Shetland wool egg cozy hit the reject pile, what with sulphur considerations and all. But I did balk at the serious suggestion that we must be careful if identifying individuals in photographs to comply with data protection regulations. Or what? Be prosecuted by posterity. We, now mainly in our 70s and 80s, will all be gone, so I think we can afford to wink at GDPR. Our capsule will be opened in a world we can't begin to imagine, by a person perhaps not yet born. And that, after all, is what makes it so alluring.
That was Laurie Graham. Finally, Isabel Hardman.
Dandelions are one of the cheeriest wildflowers. They are loved by children for their clock seed heads, are entirely edible for humans, and are a source of food for many insects and birds. And yet, many gardeners go to great lengths to get rid of them. This year's daffodils may have faded, but dandelions, their similarly coloured wild replacements, are in full swing, and it's a vintage year for them. Road verges, meadows and lawns are covered in thousands of gold polka dots, with each plant bearing half a dozen blooms. They make a boring green sward far more interesting, and are, to my mind at least, as beautiful as the daffodils that are often planted in the same spots. Wordsworth may have been banging on about daffodils, but there is no objective reason why a dandelion, which supports far more wildlife than a daffodil, should be considered lesser. Yet there are those who see it that way. Last week, President Joe Biden stopped to pick a dandelion for the First Lady while they walked to the Marine One helicopter on the White House ellipse. If you needed further proof that nothing in America can escape angry politicisation, a presenter on the right-wing site Newsmax made the wacky claim that this was a reckless thing to do, since the dandelion had gone to seed, so would give everybody asthma. Jill Biden didn't blow the seeds, perhaps because she had a mask on, not that it matters. Why, the host went on, should we see this as some kind of sweet gesture when he's giving his wife a weed? I doubt many people will share his faux outrage, but he's not alone in dismissing dandelions as mere weeds. Those who do are missing out on a lot. Dandelion leaves are peppery and were prized by Victorian cooks in salads. They're particularly nice if you blanch them under a plant pot for a few weeks before harvesting. You can turn the flowers into wine or use them in salads too. The roasted roots make a coffee. Insects feast on their nectar. Small birds, such as goldfinches, on their seeds. There are more than 200 micro-species of dandelion in the UK. They include the wonderfully named Bertha's dandelion, Taraxacum berthi, a rare species with reddish-purple stripes on its petals, the spotted dandelion, T. maculosum, which has painterly splashes of purple on its leaves, and the tiny ruddy dandelion, T. rubicundum, the smallest species in the UK, and a lovely plant with very sharply toothed leaves. These teeth on the leaves are the origin of the name dandelion. It came from the medieval Latin dens leonis, meaning lion's tooth, went via the French dent de lion, and ended up in the Middle English lexicon as dandelion. But it is also a very fitting name for the flowers, which do look like the sort of lion's manes children draw. Children tend to be better at appreciating dandelions than adults, probably because they haven't yet acquired the belief that nature is only beautiful when we are in control of it. Dandelions cheer up a boring lawn and lift you with it.
That was Isabel Hardman, and that's it for this week's episode. If you enjoyed the podcast, why not pick up a copy of the magazine? Alongside the pieces you've heard, we've got Isabel Oakeshott on the crippling costs of childcare, Matthew Paris asking who regulates the regulators, and Laura Freeman and London's fake facades. Thank you for listening, and do join us again next week.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.